Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 41 featuring Kim Bauman Larson. We're taking a bit of a break from the THU series that we are going to be continuing to do because I wanted to be able to get Kim on to talk about some of the stuff that we've been working on. Lon and I have known Kim for many years, and he came in from Norway to one of the VR conferences that are happening here in Los Angeles. He has been doing VR longer than anyone I know, probably since about 1993 or four. So he really has a deep knowledge of this. We have been talking for the better part of a year of some projects that we have some ideas about. Figured it was a good time for us to sit down and talk about it. We're continuing to do work in this area with him, and figure it was really cool to see what his ideas are and where we want to go from here. Hopefully the guys enjoy it, and that's it.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Be funny. So I was just asking Kim, I'm trying to recall when we met, well, the first time that we met, and I'm pretty sure it was in Monte Carlo at Imagina.
Yep.
And I remember specifically the presentation at that time. I was showing Dirt Map. I was showing ambient occlusion. And I thought, wow, this is the most amazing technology I've ever seen. Can you believe this? And I was joking.
This is why you're going to make me angry.
Because, right? Because I can already see Chris's face just like, what? Yeah, so even it's funny now or ironic that the beginning of the podcast says, like, you know, don't touch ambient occlusion, please. Like,
dirt maps are valid, and that's why it's called a dirt map, right? It's a dirt. It gets dirt in the corners. It's not obvious. Anyway, we're not going to go there. Why start it? Really?
The other thing I remember from that trip is it cost me $33 for a grilled cheese sandwich and a cappuccino. $33. Now, the grilled cheese sandwich had three halves, which I think maybe made it fancy. I don't know if, like, one of the cooks ate the other half or if they just kept it around until somebody else ordered a grilled cheese sandwich. But
wow. That's a pretty good grilled cheese sandwich.
I don't know that it was worth $33.
Okay.
But, you know.
Yeah, but when money is no object, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, right? It doesn't.
I think the first time I actually we met online several times, but I think the first time I actually met you was probably, I hate to say it,
Cigraph
2007,
the San Diego Cigraph.
Yeah,
the Genesis.
I think that's where it was. It very well could have been. All right. Well, we actually have an agenda. All of us have an agenda here. It's not just that we want to catch up, which we're going to do anyway. But we have all been focusing a lot on a specific kind of subject, which has become a hot subject. I know everyone's talking about it, blah, blah, blah. But the VR thing right now is incredibly important. And I think it's specifically important to the field that we've all come from. The nature of VR is to put you in a place that you've never been before, in a way that you've never been before, which would seem that architecture is the most obvious most obvious place to make that happen. There are different things that I've seen recently that I think are incredible, which also were incredible to me, but I think it's way more important than everything else that people are focusing on in terms of games and things like that, because I think that obviously if you want to show someone what their space is going to look like, a VR experience is way better than a print image of a rendering, right? So what are you in town for, Kim?
I'm in town for the second annual VR developer conference by Oculus.
Okay.
So the Oculus Connect 2.
Uh-huh.
It's a three-day event starting on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And yeah.
But you've been doing a lot of these VR talks, right? Or these VR conferences. This has been the focus of yours for a while.
Well, I actually... my VR interest goes back to when I studied in Houston.
Right.
I took my master's there, and I had...
Where did you get your master's? At U of H?
Yes, U of H. I was actually studying space architecture.
Really?
So...
what year did you graduate U of H?
I think it was 94.
94, okay.
So I worked with a small company called CyberSim. We were doing VR for compact computers.
Uh-huh.
And also NASA.
Right.
And but the technology was not ready then. That was... Yeah, it was making everybody sick, myself included.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, let's talk about that real quick. So there are people that may not necessarily know, why does VR make you sick?
Well, we have a few senses, the visual one being the dominant one. But what makes you sick is when there is not a correlation between senses. So you visually think you're moving, but your inner ear maybe think you're still.
Okay.
Because you are still physically.
Or the timing is off slightly sometimes.
Yeah, you turn your head and the visuals are not that fast that you think they would be.
Mm-hmm. And that causes nausea, right?
Yeah.
I watched a demo of walking through a space, you know, it looked like it might have been a Grecian villa or something. And it was, you know, you hit the keys to walk forward and you go up the stairs. And walking up the stairs in VR, really, like, I had to take the headset off for about 20 minutes and walk around. It was like, this is the worst experience ever.
Yeah, you know, and I've been doing a lot of it myself. And about 2 years ago, I had an inner ear infection, which was a virus that affected my balance. And I've become very sensitive to vertigo. Mm. Like, literally, if I turn my head too fast or I go on a swing with my daughter, I can get vertigo. It's kind of bad. And this is affecting a lot of people. So VR has to be sensitive to those situations, you know?
Yep.
And one of the other things that I think is funny is that a lot of people are like, oh, the game experience in VR. You know, you've played first-person shooters, right?
Oh, yeah, a lot.
A lot. If you turn that fast the way you turn in a first-person shooter, you would throw up instantly. I mean, no one can turn 180 degrees in 0.2 seconds. No. That would, yeah. So VR in games is going to be a different experience. It has to be, right? Because I think, or maybe the young kids these days, they're just going to get used to it, and they're going to be like fighter pilots and just be able to...
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, maybe we're just too old for this shit.
Absolutely.
You know? But I don't know. I mean, that's a good question about that idea. Like, VR, yeah, I don't like putting it on. I mean, we were at one event where we were trying to show someone something on an Oculus. I was like, no, because every time I put one of those things on, I get nauseous, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So so I think that there's going to be a generation issue that's going on here. But at the same time, I think it's a shame to lose that potential of what this medium actually is.
Well, and all the devices, though, now the resolution keeps getting better, the tracking keeps getting better, yep. The motion keeps getting better. The more people experiment and play with the medium, the sort of better equipped they are to understand the sensibilities and connect those senses. So it keeps improving. I mean, even in the past 6 months, I've seen a massive difference. And when you go from the last Oculus to the newest Oculus, there's a big difference. When you go to the Gear or the HTC Vive, which we have here in the office, is like, that's awesome, because now you're connected to,
and you can walk
being able to
bit.
Move and track your head and the motion, and that really starts to feel, you know, absolutely spot on, and reaching out to grab the controllers virtually or right there in space, like being able to connect those things too is pretty cool. So I think that part is going to have a massive effect on, you know, people's comfort level with it.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about what you were saying of the what VR is, because there's a debate that people have in terms of what VR is, right? So a lot of what's being created now in VR, some people are saying that's not real VR, and I'm specifically talking about pre-recorded video and or pre-rendered material, right? Yep. Why are people saying that's not real VR? And I know the reason, but I want you to hear your reason.
Well, I assume they say that's not real VR because it is less immersive than other types of VR experiences.
Okay. Why is that?
Why is that? Because you have no interactive parallax. So if you move, you shift your head from left to right, and there's a column in front of you, you won't be able to see what's behind it.
Right.
From my point of view, it's all VR. It's just it's on a continuum. It's a graduation of how immersive is it, it is.
Mm-hmm.
From the least immersive things, which would be a mono panoramic experience, maybe in a cardboard, to the most immersive, which would be either fully real time scene, or something like the Presence technology, which offers interactive parallax in pre-rendered images.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And to me, the pre-rendered content or even the some of the stationary VR components, to me, that is an entry point that's very necessary for people to get comfortable with it because it gives you an opportunity to actually experience it without having some of the discomforts that we were talking about, which is the additional motions and trying to figure out, how do I set this up to move around a volume? And technologically speaking, it's simple. It's like that's actually one of the few things that you can do on a wide scale, whether it's, Gear VR or whether it's cardboard. You can start to render out just about anything and look at it, which is kind of exciting.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly important that it's the threshold to create content is low, and that's one of the reasons I'm so excited about getting a scene into, 3D application and just rendering it out to a stereo panorama and being able to watch it right away.
Right.
And you've designed spaces, right? Like you've done architecture and you were even mentioning the ability to go back in and see some of the unbuilt work.
Yeah.
Now to open that up, like talk a little bit about that. Like what's your experience of being able to go back in and look at a design and experience it now?
Yeah, we back in 2006, we won a competition for a design hotel in my old company, Placebo Effects, and it was a beautiful little room, and it got published like in Frame magazine and stuff like that, but nothing happened of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I took that Maxine and rendered it out in V-Ray with the new stereoscopic helper.
Yeah.
And instantly I was in that room. Of course, I've been in that room already.
Sure.
But not in that way. And that was very powerful.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are just so obsessed about the next thing, next thing, next thing. They're forgetting about the fact that just rendering out a space and putting it into a viewable scenario is extremely powerful in a lot of ways, I just remember way back when I was working at Gensler in Houston, and we were designing offices for these big executives, and I had to do all these renderings to show them what their offices looked like. I mean, it'd been amazing to just go put the headset on and here, look around. That's what your office looks like, all the way around 360. You can see it. You can see it from all point of view. And it would have been solved the problem, and they would have been ecstatic, and they would probably, if they had a cardboard or a Gear VR, they would have gone to dinner parties and showing people their cool new office that they're going to build.
We actually tried that. We had our CyberSim had the offices in the Gensler office in the building, but of course, as I said, the technology was just not ready.
So that's right. Wow. Okay.
Well,
over in Penzoil Plaza.
Yeah.
Wow. See, look at this connection I had here.
How is it possible you guys didn't even run into each other?
No, I know. Jesus. Okay.
Well, one of the things that I find is important, especially because I think that there's some skepticism about the utility on VR, and I think part of that is because they've seen things that just look like a flat panorama.
Right.
It's like this is interactive QTVR, whereas that's not really the experience you want. What you want is you want that true sense of scale,
yeah,
and that true sense of depth.
Yep.
And that is a game changer, right? That is, yep, you know, so people who have maybe experienced it before, it was just kind of a flat projection, yeah, in space, is not even close.
I should note this because I think this is an important point. I want Kim to talk because I know he's got a fantastic point of view on specifically the interocular. But a lot of people have created content which they believe is stereo, and I don't think they realize it's not stereo. They just create a panoramic image, not making it stereo. They put it into a Gear VR or whatever, and it looks like I'm inside of a Cinerama dome or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And it looks good. It just basically has no sense of scale.
Exactly.
The only sense of scale you have is approximately how high the camera is, and that's about it. Mm. It looks good. I'm not knocking it, but it's not real sense of scale. In order for it to be real sense of scale, you have to set up specific things. Now, Kim, tell us what the most important thing is about setting up a sense of scale, because I know the answer, but I want people to understand why.
Well, we have two eyes. And
most of us do, and one is on the left and the other one's on the right.
Right. So we have stereoscopic vision, and and we have to recreate those eyes in 3D using two cameras.
Right.
And the distance between those two cameras should represent the distance between your eyes.
Right.
And when you render out two stereoscopic images with that close to the distance you have, you will get that sense of scale.
Mm-hmm.
But the challenge is then that people have different distance between their eyes.
They're not radically different, but they're different enough to be
a little bit different.
A little bit different. So as an example, my eyes are actually closer together than the average.
Yep.
The average that's been generally accepted is 6.5 centimeters.
Yep.
And you were talking specifically about how that's different for gender, right?
Yeah, so generally women have narrower set eyes. They're generally lower and smaller head, I guess.
Right.
And then, of course, children have way
smaller.
Way smaller, yeah.
Right. And so you can't because basically what you're doing is you're forcing a kid to be at the scale of a human. And they're not used to seeing the world
or
way.
Or an adult.
What did I say?
A human. Those are something I don't know about your kids.
I'm forcing my child to be a human. It's very embarrassing. So an adult, right. And that's very different.
Yep.
And then, if my eyes are normally closer together than normal and you render it bigger, that suddenly makes my head feel bigger, which now makes the world seem
just slightly off.
Too small.
Yeah,
my own world seems too small for me. It always does. Every time I put on a Gear VR or whatever, whenever the situation, everything looks just a little smaller than it should, and it does make an effect, right?
Yeah. So, I'm thinking when I'm going to make these images, I'm going to render out maybe three different versions.
A few versions.
Yeah. So you have, because like most people will be fitting within the, what do you call it, 90% percentile or something, 95. And it's only like 5% on the low end and 5% on the high end that are really very, very different. Like maybe, more than 7 centimeters.
The first thing I think I put on when I put on a Gear, it was an Oculus, like the very first Oculus, and they put me into some game, I forgot what it was, and I was walking around. I'm 6'3", right? The average height of the person they were doing was probably just 5'10" or something like that. I don't know, you guys can figure it out in centimeters for all you metric people out there. But basically, I felt like I was walking on my shins. You know what I mean? Like my feet, I was too short. Like there was something.
You were in the pool.
I was, it was just weird. Like I was like, the floor is too close to my feet. And it was a very strange feeling. And that has to be a sensitivity that people have. Or, you just develop an alter ego where everything is a little bit different in the other world. But that interocular distance is very critical for you to feel at the correct scale, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't set that eye distance correct, you're never going to feel as the right scale.
Yeah. Or you may set it like, as you know, Kim showed a scene of setting it specifically to be more of like a mouse, right? And you may do it for a storytelling reason, to if you want to experience what it might like to be.
Of course.
You know.
Yeah.
Looking at things in miniature or feeling miniature and being a giant. Yeah.
Well, let's bring up this thing about rules, right? Yep. Because VR, and suddenly all these people are arbitrarily making rules about VR, which I think is an interesting thing. Because I think that who says you can't break the rules? And if you break them for a reason, then that's a good idea, right? So I think rules are there to be broken, but I think a lot of people are arbitrarily saying, here's a rule, done, you know? Why is that a rule? I don't understand. But I think you have to have a set of rules in the same sense.
Call them a guideline.
Sure.
Right? Like call them a...
Well, okay. Let's just put it this way. We've gone... Let's just go as an example, because this is a new medium, just like filmmaking, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
In editing, when they first started making movies and they started editing, they had no idea how to tell a story through editing. Now... Mm. The rules are set in editing so much that it has become second nature for us to watch it. If someone breaks any of those rules, we freak out, even though we have no idea what the rules of editing is. It's just been told to us for so many years that that's how it works. You may want to look up the 180 rule in editing. You can. It's a long rule, but basically, if you break that plane, it messes everything up and you're completely confused as to where you are in space. But that's a rule in editing that we've all come to gotten used to, and maybe eventually VR is going to have similar rules.
Yeah.
You know, I know Godard loves to mess those rules, which makes his films look all freaky and disturbing, and all he's done is just broken an editing rule. And you're like, this is a weird film. I don't understand what's going on. It's like, just because he put the camera on the other side of the person, now you're all confused and it thinks it's a weird film. And it's like, it's such a simple thing, right?
Yeah.
But I've noticed people are finding these things, you know, like, oh, don't do this in VR. It's like, you know, don't move the camera too fast and go up, right? That was a rule that was invented in VR. And we just saw the Art of Patron thing.
Yep.
And you're sensitive to this. You know what the problem with VR is.
Yep.
Somehow is able to overcome it. Why? Because he made sure these other rules were not broken, like don't tilt the camera. Tilting the camera is a problem in VR for sure. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think is exciting just about what's going on is now this is a medium that people can like rush to explore. And so you're getting folks that are just, you know, really, really immersing themselves in, you know, what they can do with this and how they can break those rules or how they can tell a story, and you know, we're really trying to wrap our heads around it, which is a huge, you know, leap from where we all thought VR was in the mid-90s and so on. It's like, no, this is actually all really happening, and people are really, you know, trying to figure these things out. And
people have already basically accepted the fact that the medium exists.
Yes.
Now, before they were like, this is kind of an interesting idea. Now they've all accepted the fact that the medium exists, even though it doesn't really exist, by the way. You can't really buy an Oculus right now. You can buy a Gear VR. You can't really buy anything, but they've all accepted the fact that this exists. Billions and billions and billions of dollars is being invested into an industry which barely exists.
Yep.
So that's a cool thing. And so now it's up to us to create the medium. I think architecture is the perfect place to say it. I do. I think it's really wonderful. I think it's a wonderful place to express this. But Lon and I were talking before you arrived. Something else, so that you're very good at, or so you have a passion about, an architecture, and that's storytelling.
Yep.
Yeah. So tell me about that a little bit, your storytelling and architecture, because I have a little bit of an opinion too, and maybe I can interject, but I'd love to hear your ideas about storytelling and architecture.
Well, I teach architecture visualization in Oslo.
Yeah.
And mostly what we do is still images because, animation is too much for the bachelor students.
Sure.
But storytelling is an important part of an architectural still image.
Right.
And it's more obvious, of course, in a film.
Mm-hmm.
The storytelling now in VR is what everybody is trying to figure out how to do, right? It's because it's like going from theater to film, and people didn't understand first that you could move the camera. You didn't have to just film the stage and have in one single take.
And that's what VR was started as, right?
Yeah.
Started off like, here you are, look around, something's happening around you, mm-hmm. and then move to the next spot, et cetera, right?
Yep.
So what I think is interesting, because when I started off in visualization, and Lon and I will go on about this, but like animation and visualization was the worst. Back in the early days in like the 90s.
It was painful.
It was painful. It's like, yeah. I want to do an animation. What did they do? They set up 1,000 frames.
Yep.
And they made a path along the path where they're going to go.
They put the viewer in a wheelbarrow and pushed them down the hallway. Yeah,
that's a beautiful experience right there.
It's like, wait, that only happens in a Kubrick movie.
Yeah, a horror film. I'm like, being chased.
You only move towards the subject usually when it feels like it's a horror film.
Right. And so that's a really bad experience. And the first time I sort of realized that the architecture community had embraced cinematography or an art of editing and putting together a good story is when I saw the stuff back again, SIGGRAPH 2007, I was like, oh my God, I saw the stuff that Neoscape and Uniform and all those guys are doing. I was like, that is storytelling.
Yep.
Storytelling. And what I think is ironic is that architecture people never knew how to tell a story because they're so good at telling stories, right? Mm. You give an architecture presentation, what are you doing? Mm. You're telling the story of your space. Mm. You know, you got renderings and you get this. It's like if I'm pitching a movie, here's your space, here's what happens when you go here, you know the story. Mm. Architects know the story and they're really bad at animating it because they don't understand cinematography. So I'd say take cinematography classes and figure out how to make your story. But telling a story is very challenging. And here's the thing, like VR, I don't think anyone knows how to tell a story in VR very well yet. I mean, no. I think we're all experimenting with that, right?
Sure.
So what do you think the storytelling technique in VR is going to be?
Well, what's actually interesting about that is that a fly through in VR is a more meaningful experience.
Yeah, except you want to get sick.
Well, depending on how it's
the
done.
The Patron thing is an example of how it works, right? Totally works, right?
So there's something that's like a rule that I would have said, no, don't do that. Whereas, well, now you're not necessarily relying on cuts and close-ups and some of those normal filmmaking rules. It's, you know, that's a little different. That's changed.
I actually have, I'm planning to write a small article on this exact topic.
Yeah, me too. Maybe we can work together on it.
Sure. I have a couple of books which I use when I'm teaching. One is by, you probably know about it, it's the Bruce Block book,
okay.
Visual Story. Uh-huh. I think that book has a lot of useful reference for storytelling if you take out the one chapter that deals with frame.
Right. Because the frame is the problem.
Yeah, well,
we don't have a frame
right.
anymore.
Your frame is just different now.
Yeah. But what he's saying is that you can break any image into a set of visual components, and one is space, and one is lines, another one is shape, another one is color, and then there's tone, and then there's rhythm, and I can't remember the seventh one. But you can use these elements in VR to, you can use, for instance, tone to change the story. And one reference he uses is what was that film again? By Roman Polanski. I can't remember the name.
The Tenant?
No, it's about this woman who is insane, and everything is in...
That sounds like every one of his movies.
All the story takes part in the apartment. And at the start of the film, the cinematography is such that it's very flat in terms of tones.
Okay.
And as she spins down into insanity, the cinematography becomes much more contrasty, which supports the it enhances the drama, basically.
Right.
And so those techniques you can use in lighting a VR scene.
Okay.
So if you want to create more drama, you will make it much more contrasty. You can use, light to emphasize an area and have right. other areas in darkness. You can use color. Of course, the red, the woman in red in Matrix.
Yes. Right. but there's a lots of things that are interesting about this stuff, right? One of the things I remember at last Trojan Horse of it was a unicorn conference last year, was some guy talking about designing game levels, right? Mm. When you're designing game levels, you're trying to orient the person to try to go towards a certain part of the zone, right? And you're trying to, because you're creating a huge immersive space, how does a person really know where to go? Unbeknownst to most users, there is clues that are happening all over the place to make you go some specific way, which you can happen in VR as well. And what they use in this, one of these games is they had the color yellow. Yep. Like, so there's this weird yellow thing, and you became so used to going towards yellow that you knew where to go. You know, it's like, oh, that ladder is yellow, I'm going to go there. That's your subconscious saying that. If you played the game, you'd never realize that you were being guided by yellow the entire game. Yep. But those are the things that happen, you know?
Well, in game design, there's actually things to be learned from architecture.
Yes.
You have a simple thing like a landmark. Mm-hmm. For instance, in the Half-Life 2 game, you had this huge tower.
You could
usually almost see it from anywhere in the game. And so that is used as an element to orient yourself. You're moving towards it constantly.
Sure.
You can use paths. You can use... different what do you have in cities when you have one zone that butts up against another one, and then you have it, this, you know, this area has one style and the other one has
so
that becomes an edge, and that will
the boundaries,
the boundaries, yeah. So you can use that kind of technique, mm-hmm. to group one space together with another space.
I think it's very interesting to think about it, and I think it's really hard. I mean, I think even we were talking about it, I was talking about with Lon before, is that even in game design, they haven't quite figured out how to make a narrative work
exactly
in that area, because most games, you play for a while, you kill a bunch of things or whatever you're doing in first-person shooter, but then you get to a story point, and what do? They immediately break it.
Yeah, you go to a cutscene.
You go to a cutscene, and now you're in a cinematic experience of what's happening, which is... because they want to make it dramatic, whatever.
Well, because you're looking at it on the frame of a screen, right?
But now I'm no longer in the thing. Now, like, my character is way out here, and I see them interacting, and then they're going off on a dragon or whatever they're going to do. I was like, okay, now, but I'm no longer part of this experience, right? And so they do that all the time.
There's something I think is called emergent storytelling in games, and it happens when you have like AI, mm-hmm. and say you are wandering into this town and you manage to get one faction heading up with another one, and they start fighting, and it creates all these mayhem, and it's not really scripted, but it creates a story by the fact that you maybe lured out some enemies and they got to fight each other, something like
sure.
that.
Sure. Well, that's a different thing. I mean, I think, friends of mine, we were playing Elder Scroll, the Skyrim, and we all experienced the game completely differently, and we're just fascinated because we played for hundreds of hours. Like every other day, we'd go out to lunch, and it's like, so what did you do? And it's like some crazy thing that this person tried, and then this person tried. Like someone, like you said, he went into the main town in Skyrim and killed everyone, the entire town, just to see what would happen. The town where I need to get all my goods and services is completely vacant of people. No people whatsoever. Completely different game experience to that person. So it was kind of a little surreal to think about that, you know, to what that would be. But anyway, this is distracting from our... conversation.
I have a question for Kim too, because I know that you've spent quite a bit of time in the AR,
right?
Side of things too, and you, in some ways, I hear different things, right? There's maybe a connection between AR and VR, and that's kind of interesting, but also has AR started to like get shoved to the side because of VR, or what's your kind of take on what's going on in that?
Can we define that for those who are listening who may necessarily know the difference, and I know most of our users do, but VR means virtual reality, which completely replaces your reality, and AR means augmented reality, which means you can see the outside world and you augmented it with more CG. Yep. So I see the room that I am now, but I'm inserting a third person that's being
or
into this.
Do you use augmented reality inside virtual reality?
Wow.
Right? Right? Because
it's crazy.
Because if you substitute reality,
wouldn't that just be more VR? Just like enhanced VR? Well, VAR?
Well, personally, for me, it's true, like you said, VR is replacing AR in terms of where my interest lies. And for me, it's mostly because the technology of AR is not really ready for architecture yet, in terms of at least one-to-one scenarios where you want to have an iPad and you want to go anywhere in a city and be able to overlay your huge building on top of reality.
So, you know, a friend of mine came in, he did a podcast with me, and his name is Craig Shimahara, and he did exactly that. Mm. And he had this thing where he had a little couple of markers and stuff, and he was like, here's your building. And he showed it on a table, and there were people walking around it and looking at it. Mm. And it was huge applause, like, this is amazing, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. No one actually wanted the technology. They loved the demo. Mm. They thought it was awesome, but they saw no reason for the technology itself. It just seemed like a gimmick to them. Mm. And I'm wondering, and this was several years ago, so he just abandoned it. I'm wondering if that's the case. In a lot of cases, these demos are a disservice because they're not, the people are not necessarily seeing the potential. They're just seeing the demo, right?
Yeah. And that's, well, I guess one of the biggest challenges with VR is that you actually have to get people in front of it. I mean, it's a bit ironic. We're sitting here talking about VR. What it really should be is running around sticking Gear VR headsets onto people.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's, Chris and I have talked about this before. Like, one of the things that I was so thankful for that Google released Cardboard, right? Because it was like, this is an opportunity to start getting people, anybody, a chance to slide their phone in.
Yep.
And use it for a couple, you know, for a couple of bucks, because otherwise, you know, how do you get people to experience it or on a mass scale, right? Not just, you know, not just us who are, you know, kind of nerds about it anyway, and we're going to, like, you know, check it out because we have an interest in it. And I also think too that, you know, like Chris said before, like, yeah, we're getting too old for this shit, right? Like, we sound like Lethal Weapon, but you know, kids, your kids, right, are going to be, you know, they're as soon as you get Minecraft or something like that into a VR scenario, it's like, it's all
which
over,
you can.
Right? Because exactly. and they're, you know, they're going to put on a headset and be like, yep, I'm going to go, you know, build my new world or whatever tonight. And that whole experience will change, because people, that they're going to be able to adopt that technology just seamlessly.
Yep. Just to get back to your question, I think, about the similarities with AR and VR.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the major similarity is the use of real-time graphics, in that you need to create these kind of optimized scenes.
Right.
And
right on track where we want to talk about. Yeah. It's perfect. Go
so
ahead.
You want so basically, to do that, you need people with game experience.
Sure.
You need most architecture studios or even visualization studios don't have that kind of competence to create those kind of scenes.
Well, some of those is changing.
Yeah.
So a lot of things are changing in the real-time world, right? And that's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. I think that a lot of things are changing. Now, there are a lot more tools available.
Well, it's accessible now.
Yeah.
Right?
It's
very accessible.
Used to, like, when you and I were doing stuff and you went to buy the Quake engine, it was like, I believe, something like $500,000 to license it, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not kidding you, those who are listening, yes. If you wanted to make a game and you wanted to make it with the Quake engine, which is what everyone could buy at the time, it was $500,000. Now, it's, how much does it cost to do an Unreal?
It's free.
But I think if you want to license a game, it was like $5 a month or something stupid like that, right?
Yeah, 20, yeah.
So it's pretty much free.
Yeah.
And it is one of the best game engines out there, right?
Yeah.
And the quality is darn good, right? It's not real, though. It's not physically accurate, which is fine. It's arguable about that. And it's not necessarily as intuitive as the tools that people are already used to using, right?
Right.
But it takes a lot of effort, and you still can't just throw billions of polygons at it either, right? Like, we're used to just saying, screw it, I'll just make a whole bunch of trees.
Yep.
So where do you think that balance is between where people are going to be able to use real time and where people are going to use pre-rendered material?
I think there's going to be definitely the use for both, but it's going to take more time from having a space that comes from the a model comes from the architects until you get something in an Unreal scene that looks as good as you want it.
Okay.
And that time is going to be much longer than using a pre-rendered technique.
Okay.
And that dictates what kind of scenarios and what kind of settings you can use the two different types of VR experiences.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've been noticing is that, you know, well, we mentioned this before about you need to... There needs to be a reason, right? There needs to be something that you do with this. It's not just technology for technology's sake. If you're going to go into real time, use that to your advantage. And VR is a perfect example of being able to use that to your advantage because it gives people the option to explore.
Yeah.
Some of the things that I've seen are I've seen people try to recreate just the cinematic animation using real-time engine, and I look at that and I go, what's the point? Like, why?
The whole point of having an interactive zone is to be interactive,
right? Yeah. So like, let's and again, you know, some of these things take time, so it takes a little bit of time for people to get comfortable with the tools, and maybe that's just what's happening is there's you got to get to a comfort level, but I want to see it go beyond that. Like if we're gonna get into, you know, the time and effort that it takes to get into a real-time engine, let's do something meaningful with it.
Yep.
That's beyond just, you know, an offline rendered animation.
Yeah, so then you could have maybe a scene where you would change out the different heights of the ceiling interactively, or you could change certain aspect of the design of maybe it's an interior. That would make it valuable.
Yes, and it's the kind of like, what's the script, like what's it, maybe it's not necessarily a story, I'm putting up my quote fingers, right? No. but there is a rationale, there is something that you want someone to experience, whether it's a design change option or yep. or, you know, a view corridor, who knows, but like you have to think about what it is that you want to achieve with it.
Mm-hmm.
And not to be like, yeah, you know, it's like...
There's one huge use for interactive in architecture, which is somebody's going to, you know, take that market. I'm not sure if it's going to be one of the big players, but actually imagine you could create a space in one-to-one scale. You would need a new kind of CAD tool where you could, you know, interactively model your architectural space, and you could seamlessly go from... it being a scale model, then you would be huge and you would look down at the model and it would be small, and then yep. you could be inside it. It's like we haven't been able to model a space in one-to-one ever.
Scale. And virtual reality starts to give us
yeah.
that scaled environment, that scaled immersive environment that you could start to think about. Like yeah. what was the, there was a really cool demo recently where, you know, the guy was painting in...
Yeah, Glenn Keane.
Yeah, and yeah. he was painting in VR at, you know, this... big scale. Imagine if you can construct or design space.
But you can't just take SketchUp or some kind of tool and, you know, kind of add some tools to it and make it a VR tool. You have to create a tool, I think, from ground up.
Yeah.
Where you use your hands to...
Right. It's like cross between Minority Report and...
Well, the thing is, you really... At that point, you need to be in a completely immersive environment, right? You have to be able to walk around and make things happen. And that's fine. But
you're going to need to be on like an airport, like a field. If
you wanna, well, the thing is, okay.
Like designing a room is one thing.
Well, that was a thing because, you know, they've, let's talk about Minority Report for a second, right? People was like, Minority Report, that's the future. It's like, well, they tried Minority Report interface. You know what? it's really tiring.
Yeah.
You got to wave your arms around all over the place. Yeah, you know, what I do with my mouse is like barely move it, you know, 5-10 centimeters, and I'm like, that's all I do all day. And I create entire cities that way. Mm-hmm. So if I have to freaking run around and put blocks up there, no,
right.
No. Where's the practical reasons for
everything that? Will be designed smaller because you just ran out of energy. You're like, no, it's only going to be like 8 feet long.
That's right.
We don't need to go those extra couple of steps.
I can change my interocular, make myself a giant, and then basically, you know, make Lego blocks, you know. But I think that there's a reason behind that. It's like, it doesn't always, it just, the computer is a relaxing environment. You can create your stuff. Talked about it with Kevin Mack the other day, where he was doing matte paintings, and literally matte paintings the size of a room. And he had to put a respirator on, and he was designing galaxies for Star Trek and stuff like that. And he's like, I had to paint the entire wall and stuff like that. I hated it. And he says, and finally it says, you know, you can sit in front of a computer and just do matte paintings in Photoshop. He's like, yes! Isn't that better? I mean, why would you, like, imagine, it's like, now you could do a matte painting. Imagine if they said, now put on this VR headset and freaking climb ladders and shit again? No, right. I don't want to do that.
It's a difference between like going and painting your house or like taking a photograph and painting a photograph of your
yes.
house.
Yes. I mean, the practical thing is like, you know, yeah, I mean, I understand the need for it, and or experiencing it, right? You want to see the car, what it looks like in that scale, and see how high the door handles are, or in a room, in an architecture room. You want to understand how that makes sense to me that you do that, but actually laboring along in VR just sounds tiring, you know, to me. I don't know.
You can get a workout. You can get a workout.
Well, fine. Yeah. Then let's make it a workout, but like, don't make it as...
And this is like, prove it. What did you do?
I don't know.
You have to put on these goggles.
I don't know. It just seems very tedious to me. I mean, yeah. I think that, and those are all things that are worth talking about and thinking about. I mean, the whole point of VR is experiencing something, right? Mm-hmm. So... And I think it's the same thing with storytelling. You want to tell a story. You want to tell a narrative. And you want people to experience that emotionally speaking. So yeah, it's really kind of interesting.
I may or may not have just watched Hackers. Which, for those of you that haven't seen it in a while, I was actually pretty amazed. It came out in 95. I was pretty amazed at how close they got to the look of the VR headset with headphones and the little treadmill that the guy's on.
Uh-huh.
It was like, wait, this is pretty accurate. It's not that far off.
Have you seen the little treadmills of that they do for Oculus, where it's like a little bowl. Yeah. Right.
I ordered one on Kickstarter. I still haven't got it.
Okay.
Of course you did, Kim. Of course you did. That's awesome.
So
except we're gonna have to go to Norway to use it. Oh, trip to Norway.
I like it. Just let's just go in the summertime if that's possible. Okay, let me see some of the other things we're talking about. How do you tell a story? You teach classes, you teach this stuff. So what do you tell your students when they want to tell a story in architecture or in a spatial story of some kind?
I assume you're talking about an architectural image, yes?
Well, it could be anything. How do you tell a story? How do you tell a story of architecture?
Well, I guess the main difference from the reference is that... you're telling a story about a building, not about a character.
Sure.
And so some of the techniques that, it's somewhat more challenging because suddenly all your people that you put in the story are no longer, they're only supporting the building, yeah?
Yes, but when you tell a story of architecture, I may be wrong, but generally you take whoever's listening and you try to put them in your space.
Yes.
So you make the subject, whoever's watching, you make them the main character.
So one of the examples I use when I teach storytelling is I have this image from some colleagues of mine in Norway, a company called Mir.
Those guys are cool.
They do awesome work.
Love those guys.
They put a lot of story in their images. And
yes.
there's like one image where they are depicting a museum on Greenland, and it's like it's situated on this rock, and you see all this magnificent fjord, And you have this one lone character standing on in shadow on the cliff looking down. And the reference they used was Indiana Jones.
Okay.
So, like, it's this hero guy. He comes through, you know, the wild, and he comes to this final place, and he looks down, and he sees the Shangri-La. He sees the building, and it's lit, beautifully lit with light coming down on it. And so that's a very powerful story about the how majestic this location and this building is in that natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in the process of discovering it. And they're, one of the things that I really appreciate about their work is that they were some of the first, you know, one of the first studios to really stop using the high noon sunlight, right? And I have a feeling that, you know, part of that is just from, like, that's not what they were experiencing when they walked outside, right?
Exactly.
That's not
the...
They're in Norway. They don't know what a sun strip looks like.
Lotharingen,
right?
Everything's kind of like at the horizon.
But it was, like, so refreshing to see some, you know, some drama in the sky and some atmosphere. And, and you know, obviously that was a reaction to, like, what they were experiencing. But there was a span in there for a while where, you know, people would drop in a sunlight and put it at like 3 o'clock and go, there you go.
Yeah.
Like, no.
Well,
because as a photographer, you would never go. I mean, maybe you would go out if there was something specific you were trying to catch for. But most,
again, the rules are broken for a reason, right?
Yep. But most of the time, as a photographer, you're up early in the morning to get out there for sunrise
or
you're waiting for magic hour,
right?
For when, you know, the sun's going down.
But the cool thing about Norway, and, like, I remember this was Eric Barba when he was over in shooting Oblivion over in Iceland. He goes, best thing about Iceland, magic hour is like 3.5 hours.
you can really get some shots going.
Goes from about, you know, 11 o'clock till 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you have a long time while that sun is sort of in that perfect, beautiful little zone, right?
There's Stu Maswich. He has a blog, and he has one article there where he talks about photography, and he has this Venn diagram, and it's fact, light, and moment.
Moment, yeah.
Okay.
So that's for him when he gets the perfect picture. It contains all those things. The fact is that, yes, I can communicate this building, and know where it's situated, what is, you know, what its main features are. I use the light to explain also, to create a drama maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to design that moment. When you're a photographer, you're waiting for it to happen.
Right.
Yep.
But as an artist, we create the whole world. So we have to design that moment.
Which sometimes can feel artificial if you don't do it well, you know?
Yep. Well, and that's actually, because that's, you know, back when I was doing visualization, that was something that was very key to
don't make it feel forced.
Yeah, well, if you don't have a moment, it feels like,
why was I here?
It feels like, okay, it's just another random photograph of something, and that you're not capturing something specific.
Right.
And you know, going back to that mirror piece, by having the discovery moment of that, you know, Indiana Jones character seeing this, you know, beautiful museum reveal itself on the horizon, is suddenly that's capturing a moment. There is a moment in time that places that. As soon as you remove that character, you know, maybe the moment is the shaft of light that hits but it's much less tangible,
yes.
Right? And that becomes further removed for the viewer, and then it feels somewhat more ordinary.
Yeah.
And that's a really important, I think, piece in communicating.
To tie this back to VR, because I think there's a very good correlation about the moment, okay? If you're going to take that Venn diagram to describe light, obviously something we can achieve, and then fact of, you know, why we're there. But the moment is something that can really help. And it could be very subtle. As an example, if you saw the Crimson Peak VR thing that we showed you, there's a butterfly that you noticed in the thing. And the butterfly is guiding you to look at specific things, right? Mm. It's a thing that you use to follow. So you, it is your guide, right? It's, in this case, it's a very subtle guide. It could be a much less subtle guide. You could literally have a VR, a CG character in your scene.
Right, or a big arrow.
Well, or whatever. Like a CG character, but please look over here. You know, like imagining having a tour of the White House. And if you're following someone or doing something of that nature, that could make a lot more sense. Why would I be going down this hallway? But if I'm following someone, that makes sense.
You know? Right. And you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because in some ways VR, even right now, the ability to experience the fact, right? Mm-hmm. You can spend a lot of time on looking at, like, I've never been able to see this space before. I'm now, like, the moment is almost you getting to experience it.
Sure.
Right? Mm-hmm. But I think for the medium to graduate and to you know, into a meaningful storytelling, into a storytelling medium, you know, that needs to be explored, right? Like, what is that Indiana Jones moment that you find in VR when you're looking at a space, or are you Indiana Jones in that? And does it feel differently if you're the person that's on the bluff looking at the building and seeing it for the first time than if, you know, you're looking at the screen and you're trying to put yourself in that? I think that's a really interesting, you know, I'm curious to see how that all shakes out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I hope that we get over the, like, hey, follow me down the hallway stuff pretty quickly, because that's going to be, you know, the follow the feather, the butterfly, the, you know,
that's going to be the
dandelion. It's like, oh, like Christ.
You were the person who was complaining about the damn feather from what's it called?
From Forrest Gump.
For Forrest Gump.
No, Forrest Gump. Forrest Gump. Perfect, right?
Because it was the first time it was done.
The problem is that everybody, like, you know, I forget, was American Beauty where they did the paper, the plastic bag, and like everybody wants to do that moment. And I remember, you know, years back there was an animation done for the Spire Tower in Chicago.
Yeah, I remember that one.
And that one was, I think it was like,
oh, the Sony ImageWorks did that one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
That was their attempt at getting into
visualization. I mean, it was you know, it was kind of really nicely rendered and everything like that. But it used this, like, dandelion following the dandelion around, and it's like, man, we've seen this device, you know, too many times.
Yeah, so, I think they were a little bit like, well, we're a big visual effects company, and we're going to show these people how it's done, and we're going to, like, totally blow the industry. It's like, yeah, you don't realize how much these people have already done this stuff, you know?
Right.
I think, and then there was a, you know, there's a way of telling stories. And the problem that we have with the ArcViz situation right now is that a lot of stories are, buy this $1 million condo, so it's all, like, get into this expensive car and cheap, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's very gauche.
Well, there was a time I actually I used to do some presentations about, like, how storytelling had evolved and then kind of devolved for a slight time, because I remember there was a specific moment when I felt like it sort of had the, you know, Fonzie jumped a shark, where you know, we were trying to build all these beautiful animations, you know, and that kind of had a music video style and a very, you know, very connected to the music, and then you change the story for the audience when it's like the Plaza Hotel, right? It's a much more lavish, luxurious, you know, details that you want to get into. And then there was this animation where it was at the kind of height of the boom, the real estate market in New York City, and the owner of the development, you know, I think they had a specific Ferrari, and that Ferrari needed to be, like, in the, you know, in it, and they were, I think the artist's name was Guido Argentini. He's the guy who's well known for painting nude models silver, and so it was like they had this, you know, these nude models painted silver. You know, these beautiful photographs of Guido Argentini's work, and they're like, how do you turn that into, you know, a device for telling the story? And there was a 100-foot-tall painted silver model revealing the building, and I was like, I think we went too far. Like, I think we may have just like gone a little bit too far. Mm-hmm. And that was, but that was perfect for the moment of what was happening in real estate. But it was a little gauche, right? It felt like.
And I think it's a little left of gauche.
and since then, I think that there's been and actually that was right before the kind of crash of 08, you know, when kind of architecture sort of worldwide came to a bit of a standstill. And since then, I've seen it reboot in what I would consider a more authentic. I don't know. I feel like the stories have become more authentic and people are a little bit more, I don't know. I haven't seen that kind of story happen. It's a little bit more honest about what's going on. And people are a little bit, I don't know. Authentic is the best word I can use to describe it.
Right.
And it's good. I'm glad. Right? Because it got weird for a little while.
Yeah.
Like real weird.
Now let's because this got me thinking about something else that I want to talk about, because I think this is where another thing that architecture could get involved with in VR, and I think it's the other way around. Instead of architecture using VR, what if VR used the architecture? And here's what's the important part of what I want to think is important. That sounded like a weird sentence, but the world of VR right now, there's going to be a huge demand on creating worlds, including exactly. architecture.
Absolutely.
And we are at the forefront of allowing that to happen. And yep. we are no longer constrained by all the engineering problems that I hated when I was in architecture. You know, so one of the things I experienced recently, and I did a podcast with him, is my one of my old VFX supervisors named Kevin Mack, who's an amazing person. He's also an incredible artist. And he does all of his art in Houdini. It's kind of crazy, very psychedelic looking stuff, but really beautiful. And he created this very abstract art world in VR.
Yeah.
And it's called ShapeSpace, and you guys should totally check it out. But that is an experience. That's a spatial experience that people should be able to experience. And I think it's an opportunity for the architecture community to design worlds, you know? I mean, imagine, you know, Lebius Woods designing VR worlds.
Absolutely. It's like...
You stole my point.
Sorry.
That was my third reason when I gave a lecture to architecture studio in Norway just a couple of weeks ago. And I said the exact same thing. This is a huge opportunity for architects to create space.
But they're not going to go to architects. I guarantee you they're going to go to concept designers, right?
Yep.
And it's a real shame. And I think the architects... they should start really thinking about this and showing how they understand space, right? Yeah. But it's not going to take your normal guy who designs an office building. No. That person's not going to know how to make a VR experience that's going to be interesting. It's going to take the people like the Morphosis guys who else would be Asymptote, right? Kareem Rashid. Honey Rashid, his brother.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Imagine a space like that or Zaha. Yeah. Zaha should be just doing a bunch of VR space by now, you know?
Yeah.
Screw all this gravity. You don't need any of that.
Forget about construction costs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think creating worlds like that would be beautiful in that architecture space.
Well, when I first got involved in visualization, That was my goal. My goal was like, I want to be able to find a way to use all of these tools so that I can be a better designer. And I felt like the path that I went, I got to design a lot more things that were built or were, you know, presented or whatever than I would have had I gone through the traditional medium.
Sure.
And right now I see like that's one of the most exciting things is
exactly.
not only can you design it, but you can react to it in a way that you've never been able to, or you can experience it in a way that you've never been able to experience it before.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just be like, here's my thought on, you know, space, and there's no bounds, right? There's no limitations. There's not many limitations. There's some, and I think I think, yes, the, you know, some of the architecture studios should get involved, but also the visualization studios, because they're uniquely equipped. They've already got...
Oh, they've solved all the technical problems.
They have, they have the technical problems. They have some of the storytelling things down. They they understand, you know, they've built up a lot of time working on space and design and so on, and it's awesome, right? In fact, that's... you know, in a week from today, I head to Venice to State of Art, and that's part of, you know, kind of my call to action for I think some of the audience is like,
oh yeah,
the VR is like yours. Yes. You should own this,
exactly,
right? Like,
and
this
not
is
just
your
own
me-
it
this
as is, a, not just own it, yeah, not just own it as a way to convey your architecture, but a way to convey things that would never be built. Make your own worlds.
Yeah. Because the demand for virtual worlds is about to skyrocket.
Yep. Right.
And that's pretty interesting. And I hope that we're not stuck with like somebody's crappy virtual conference room for when we all decide to meet in VR and it's you know, this just looks like, you know, a crappy conference room. Like, who wants to meet there, right?
No, I want to meet in I want to meet in P. Diddy's living room. Or whatever, you know, like just imagine. But you know what else? If we don't do anything, if we don't do anything about this, the architecture and design community, it's going to turn into like the Winamp skins. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You remember when Winamp's like, yeah, you can design any skin. How ugly was that world?
Yeah.
It's going to be like ugly, ugly, ugly colors and just. Gaudy, right? And it's our responsibility as designers, call to action. I think you're right.
Yep.
We understand how to compose space and how to make it work, and I think it's our responsibility.
I don't want to experience a shitty virtual world. Like that will be an abject failure of VR if it's, you know, if it becomes a shitty world.
Like, yeah.
No.
I 100% agree.
That's it. Now I got I'm going to start designing again. That's like
cool.
Let's do it. Cool. Let's do it. I love it. All right, Ken. I think we've covered all the major parts that I want to talk about. We will probably, because this is a conversation that's going to be ongoing, right? Yep. So next time we either go to Norway or he comes here or whatever.
No, we got to go to Norway, I think.
I like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When's the best time to go?
December.
Christmas? No. I don't know. Probably summer.
Yeah. Summertime. Okay.
Or spring or early fall.
Or spring. Hmm. Spring in Norway sounds nice.
Yeah. Sounds like a movie.
I know. Salmon fishing pretty good in Norway?
Yeah.
Norwegian salmon is delicious. I know that. All right. We're at an hour and 6 minutes, which is perfect. I think we're a beautiful, beautiful podcast. I really appreciate you coming in town. I'm so excited we're here. Now we're going to get some lunch just because I'm starving.
Great.
This is exactly the conversation we want to have. So thanks, Kim.
Thanks for having me.
And it's kind of, I think, this is the conversation we want to start to bring up with this idea of our Digital Design League,
yes.
Right? Getting some people involved that are thinking about this and trying to kind of maybe pave a path for or just, you know, kind of create a pathway for people to go down the road, not necessarily set rules, but maybe help understand some of the technology or what to explore.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, this is kind of a first step in that Digital Design League.
Because I think that's been a little bit of my frustration. I think you're right. My frustration has been that people are become sort of about technology in terms of visualization. I think this is an opportunity for them to embrace it and create new things, right?
Yep.
So, all right, cool. All right, okay. We're letting the last bucket drop. I'm hungry.
Thanks, Kim.
Thanks, Kim, for coming.
Thank you.